He received a tumultuous welcome. At every village hastily decorated in his honor, there were cheering crowds. During the afternoon, he reached his first goal, Linz, where he had spent his school days. The reception there was delirious, and Hitler was deeply touched. The next day, after getting off a telegram to Mussolini, "I shall never forget you for this," he laid a wreath on the graves of his parents at Leonding, and then returned to Linz to make a speech. "When years ago I went forth from this town, I bore within me precisely the same profession of faith which today fills my heart. Judge the depth of my emotion when after so many years I have been able to bring that profession of faith to its fulfillment. If Providence once called me forth from this town to be the leader of the Reich, it must in so doing have charged me with a mission, and that mission could only be to restore my dear homeland to the German Reich. I have believed in this mission. I have lived and fought for it, and I believe I have now fulfilled it." On the afternoon of the 12th, Seyss Inquart, accompanied by Himmler, had flown to Linz to meet Hitler and had proudly proclaimed that Article 88 of the Treaty of Saint-Germain, which proclaimed Austria's independence as inalienable and made the League of Nations its guarantor, had been voided. To Hitler, carried away by the enthusiasm of the Austrian crowds, this was not enough. He ordered Dr. Wilhelm Stuckart, an undersecretary in the Ministry of the Interior who had been rushed by his minister, Frick, to Vienna to draft a law making Hitler president of Austria, to come at once to Linz. Somewhat to the surprise of this legal expert, the Führer instructed him, as he later deposed at Nuremberg, to draft a law providing for a total Anschluss. This draft Stuckart presented to the newly formed Austrian government in Vienna on Sunday, March 13th. The day on which Schuschnigg's plebiscite was to have been held. President Miklas, as we have seen, refused to sign it, but Seyss Inquart, who had taken over the president's powers, did, and late that evening flew back to Linz to present it to the Führer. It proclaimed the end of Austria. Austria, it began, is a province of the German Reich. Hitler shed tears of joy, Seyss Inquart later recalled. The so-called Anschluss law was also promulgated the same day at Linz by the German government and signed by Hitler, Göring, Ribbentrop, Frick, and Hess. It provided for a free and secret plebiscite on April 10th, in which the Austrians could determine the question of reunion with the German Reich. The Reich Germans, Hitler announced on March 18th, were also to have a plebiscite on the Anschluss, along with new elections to the Reichstag. Hitler did not make his triumphal entry into Vienna, where he had lived so long as a tramp, until the afternoon of Monday, March 14th. He was delayed by two unforeseen developments. Despite the delirium of the Austrians at the prospect of seeing the Führer in the capital, Himmler asked for an extra day to perfect security arrangements. He was already carrying out the arrest of thousands of unreliables. Within a few weeks, the number would reach 79,000 in Vienna alone. Also, the vaunted German panzer units had broken down long before they got within sight of Vienna's hills. According to Jodl, some 70% of the armored vehicles were stranded on the road from Salzburg and Passau to Vienna, though General Guderian, who commanded the panzer troops, later contended that only 30% of his forces became stalled. At any rate, Hitler was furious at the delay. He remained in Vienna only overnight, putting up at the Hotel Imperial. Still, this triumphant return to the former imperial capital, which he felt had rejected him and condemned him in his youth to a starved and miserable gutter life, and which now was acclaiming him with such tumultuous jubilation, could not have failed to revive his spirits. The ubiquitous Papen, rushing by plane from Berlin to Vienna to get in on the festivities, found Hitler in the reviewing stand opposite the Hofburg, the ancient palace of the Habsburgs. "I can only describe him," Papen later wrote, "as being in a state of ecstasy." Yet underneath the ecstasy, and unnoticed by the shallow Papen, there may have burned in Hitler a feeling of revenge for a city and a people which had not appreciated him as a young man, and which at heart he despised. This in part may have accounted for his brief stay, though a few weeks later he would publicly say to the Burgomaster of Vienna, "Be assured that this city is, in my eyes, a pearl. I will bring it into a setting which is worthy of it." This was probably more electioneering propaganda than an expression of his inner feelings. These feelings were revealed to Baldur von Schirach, the Nazi governor and Gauleiter of Vienna during the war at a heated meeting at the Berghof in 1943. Describing it during his testimony at Nuremberg, Schirach said, "Then the Führer began with, I might say, incredible and unlimited hatred to speak against the people of Vienna. At 4 o'clock in the morning, Hitler suddenly said something which I should now like to repeat for historical reasons. He said, Vienna should never have been admitted into the Union of the Greater Germany. Hitler never loved Vienna. He hated its people." Papen's own festive spirits on March 14th were spoiled that same day when he learned that Wilhelm von Ketteler, his close friend and aide at the German legation, had disappeared under circumstances which indicated foul play by the Gestapo. 3 years before, another friend and collaborator at the legation, Baron Tschirschke, had fled to England to escape certain death from the SS. At the end of April, Ketteler's body was fished out of the Danube, where Gestapo thugs in Vienna had thrown it after murdering him. Hitler remained in this state during most of the next 4 weeks, when he traversed Germany and Austria from one end to the other, whipping up public fervor for a big Ja vote in favor of the Anschluss. But in his exuberant speeches he missed no opportunity to vilify Schuschnigg or to peddle the by now shop-worn lies about how the Anschluss was achieved. In his address to the Reichstag on March 18th, he asserted that Schuschnigg had broken his word by his election forgery, adding that only a crazy, blinded man could have behaved in such a manner. On March 25th at Königsberg, the election forgery had become, in Hitler's mind, this ridiculous comedy. Letters had been found, Hitler claimed, proving that Schuschnigg had deliberately double-crossed him by seeking delays in augmenting the Berchtesgaden Agreement until a more propitious hour to stir up foreign countries against Germany. In Königsberg, Hitler also answered the taunts of the foreign press that his use of brutal force and his trickery in having proclaimed the Anschluss without even waiting for the decision of the plebiscite. "Certain foreign newspapers have said that we fell on Austria with brutal methods. I can only say even in death they cannot stop lying. I have in the course of my political struggle won much love from my people, but when I crossed the former frontier into Austria, there met me such a stream of love as I have never experienced. Not as tyrants have we come, but as liberators. Under the force of this impression, I decided not to wait until April 10th, but to effect the unification forthwith." If this sounded less than logical, or honest, to foreign ears, there is no doubt that it made a great impression on the Germans. When at the conclusion of his Reichstag speech, Hitler implored, in a voice choked with emotion, "German people, give me another 4 years, so that I can now exploit the accomplished union for the benefit of all," he received an ovation so overwhelming that it dwarfed all his former triumphs at this tribune. The Führer wound up his election campaign in Vienna on April 9th, on the eve of the polling. The man who had once tramped the pavements of this city as a vagabond, unwashed and empty-bellied, who but 4 years before had assumed in Germany the powers of the Hohenzollern kings and had now taken upon himself those of the Habsburg emperors, was full of a sense of God-given mission. "I believe that it was God's will to send a youth from here into the Reich, to let him grow up, to raise him to be the leader of the nation, so as to enable him to lead back his homeland into the Reich. There is a higher ordering, and we all are nothing else than its agents. When on March 9th Herr Schuschnigg broke his agreement, then in that second I felt that now the call of Providence had come to me, and that which then took place in 3 days was only conceivable as the fulfillment of the wish and the will of this Providence. In 3 days the Lord has smitten them, and to me the grace was given on the day of the betrayal to be able to unite my homeland with the Reich. I would now give thanks to him who let me return to my homeland in order that I might now lead it into my German Reich. Tomorrow may every German recognize the hour and measure its import and bow in humility before the Almighty, who in a few weeks has wrought a miracle upon us." That a majority of Austrians, who undoubtedly would have said Ja to Schuschnigg on March 13th, would say the same to Hitler on April 10th, was a foregone conclusion. Many of them sincerely believed that ultimate union with any kind of Germany, even a Nazi Germany, was a desirable and inevitable end. that Austria, cut off from its vast Slavic and Hungarian hinterland in 1918, could not in the long run exist decently by itself, that it could only survive as part of the German Reich. In addition to these Austrians were the fanatical Nazis, whose ranks were swelling rapidly with job-seekers and job-holders attracted by success and anxious to improve their position. Many Catholics in this overwhelmingly Catholic country were undoubtedly swayed by a widely publicized statement of Cardinal Innitzer, welcoming Nazism to Austria and urging a Ja vote. A few months later, on October 8th, the Cardinal's palace opposite St. Stephen's Cathedral was sacked by Nazi hooligans. Too late, Innitzer had learned what National Socialism was and had spoken out in a sermon against the Nazi persecution of his church. In a fair and honest election in which the Social Democrats and Schuschnigg's Christian Socials would have had freedom to campaign openly, the plebiscite, in my opinion, might have been close. As it was, it took a very brave Austrian to vote no. As in Germany, and not without reason, the voters feared that their failure to cast an affirmative ballot might be found out. In the polling station which I visited in Vienna that Sunday afternoon, wide slits in the corner of the polling booths gave the Nazi election committee sitting a few feet away a good view of how one voted. In the country districts, few bothered or dared to cast their ballots in the secrecy of the booth. They voted openly for all to see. I happened to broadcast at 7:30 that evening, a half hour after the polls had closed, when few votes had yet been counted. A Nazi official assured me before the broadcast that the Austrians were voting 99% Ja. That was the figure officially given later. 99.08% in Greater Germany, 99.75% in Austria. And so, Austria, as Austria, passed for a moment out of history, its very name suppressed by the revengeful Austrian who had now joined it to Germany. The ancient German word for Austria, Österreich, was abolished. Austria became the Ostmark, and soon even that name was dropped, and Berlin administered the country by Gaue, districts, which corresponded roughly to the historic Länder, such as Tyrol, Salzburg, Styria, and Carinthia. Vienna became just another city of the Reich, a provincial district administrative center withering away. The former Austrian tramp, become dictator, had wiped his native land off the map and deprived its once glittering capital of its last shred of glory and importance. Disillusionment among the Austrians was inevitable. For the first few weeks, the behavior of the Vienna Nazis was worse than anything I had seen in Germany. There was an orgy of sadism. Day after day, large numbers of Jewish men and women could be seen scrubbing Schuschnigg signs off the sidewalk and cleaning the gutters. While they worked on their hands and knees with jeering stormtroopers standing over them, crowds gathered to taunt them. Hundreds of Jews, men and women, were picked off the streets and put to work cleaning public latrines and the toilets of the barracks where the SA and the SS were quartered. Tens of thousands more were jailed. Their worldly possessions were confiscated or stolen. I myself, from our apartment in the Plosselgasse, watched squads of SS men carting off silver, tapestries, paintings, and other loot from the Rothschild palace next door. Baron Louis de Rothschild himself was later able to buy his way out of Vienna by turning over his steel mills to the Hermann Göring Works. Perhaps half of the city's 180,000 Jews managed, by the time the war started, to purchase their freedom to emigrate by handing over what they owned to the Nazis. This lucrative trade in human freedom was handled by a special organization set up under the SS by Heydrich, the Office for Jewish Emigration, which became the sole Nazi agency authorized to issue permits to Jews to leave the country. Administered from the beginning to the end by an Austrian Nazi, a native of Hitler's hometown of Linz by the name of Karl Adolf Eichmann, it was to become eventually an agency not of emigration, but of extermination, and to organize the slaughter of more than 4 million persons, mostly Jews. Himmler and Heydrich also took advantage of their stay in Austria during the first weeks of the Anschluss to set up a huge concentration camp at Mauthausen, on the north bank of the Danube near Enns. It was too much trouble to continue to transport thousands of Austrians to the concentration camps of Germany. Austria, Himmler decided, needed one of its own. Before the Third Reich tumbled to its fall, the non-Austrian prisoners were to outnumber the local inmates, and Mauthausen was to achieve the dubious record as the German concentration camp, the extermination camps in the East were something else, with the largest number of officially listed executions, 35,318 in the 6.5 years of its existence. Despite the Gestapo terror led by Himmler and Heydrich after the Anschluss, Germans flocked by the hundreds of thousands to Austria, where they could pay with their marks for sumptuous meals not available in Germany for years, and for bargain-priced vacations amid Austria's matchless mountains and lakes. German businessmen and bankers poured in to buy up the concerns of dispossessed Jews and anti-Nazis at a fraction of their value. Among the smiling visitors was the inimitable Dr. Schacht, who, despite his quarrels with Hitler, was still a minister, without portfolio, in the Reich cabinet, still the president of the Reichsbank, and who was overjoyed with the Anschluss. Arriving to take over the Austrian National Bank on behalf of the Reichsbank even before the plebiscite, he addressed the staff of the Austrian Bank on March 21st. Ridiculing the foreign press for criticizing Hitler's methods of affecting the Union, Dr. Schacht stoutly defended the methods, arguing that the Anschluss was the consequence of countless perfidies and brutal acts of violence which foreign countries have practiced against us. Thank God Adolf Hitler has created a communion of German will and German thought. He bolstered it up with the newly strengthened Wehrmacht, and he then finally gave the external form to the inner union between Germany and Austria. Not a single person will find a future with us who is not wholeheartedly for Adolf Hitler. The Reichsbank will always be nothing but National Socialist, or I shall cease to be its manager. Whereupon Dr. Schacht administered to the Austrian staff an oath to be faithful and obedient to the Führer. "A scoundrel, he who breaks it," Dr. Schacht cried, and then led his audience in the bellowing of a triple Sieg Heil. In the meantime, Dr. Schuschnigg had been arrested and subjected to treatment so degrading that it is difficult to believe that it was not prescribed by Hitler himself. Kept under house arrest from March 12th until May 28th, during which time the Gestapo contrived to prevent him from getting any sleep by the most petty devices, he was then taken to Gestapo headquarters at the Hotel Metropole in Vienna, where he was incarcerated in a tiny room on the 5th floor for the next 17 months. There, with the towel issued to him for his personal use, he was forced to clean the quarters, wash basins, slop buckets, and latrines of the SS guards, and perform other various menial tasks thought up by the Gestapo. By March 11th, the first anniversary of his fall, he had lost 58 pounds, but the SS doctor reported that his condition was excellent. The years of solitary confinement and then of life among the living dead in some of the worst of the German concentration camps, such as Dachau and Sachsenhausen, that followed, have been described by Dr. Schuschnigg in his book, Austrian Requiem. Shortly after his arrest, he was allowed to marry by proxy the former Countess Vera Chernin, whose marriage had been annulled by an ecclesiastical court. At this time, Schuschnigg was a widower. And in the last war years, she was permitted to share his existence in the concentration camps along with their child, who was born in 1941. How they survived the nightmare of imprisonment is a miracle. Toward the end, they were joined by a number of other distinguished victims of Hitler's wrath, such as Dr. Schacht, Léon Blum, the former French premier, and Madame Blum, Pastor Niemüller, a host of high-ranking generals, and Prince Philip of Hesse, whose wife, Princess Mafalda, the daughter of the King of Italy, had been done to death by the SS at Buchenwald in 1944 as part of the Führer's revenge for Victor Emmanuel's desertion to the Allied side. On May 1, 1945, the eminent group of prisoners who had been hastily evacuated from Dachau and transported southward to keep them from being liberated by the Americans advancing from the west arrived at a village high in the mountains of southern Tyrol. The Gestapo officers showed Schuschnigg a list of those who, on Himmler's orders, were to be done away with before they fell into the hands of the Allies. Schuschnigg noted his own name and that of his wife, neatly printed. His spirits fell. To have survived so much, so long, and then to be bumped off at the last minute. On May 4th, however, Schuschnigg was able to write in his diary, "At 2 o'clock this afternoon, alarm! The Americans! An American detachment takes over the hotel. We are free." Without firing a shot and without interference from Great Britain, France, and Russia, whose military forces could have overwhelmed him, Hitler had added 7 million subjects to the Reich and gained a strategic position of immense value to his future plans. Not only did his armies flank Czechoslovakia on three sides, but he now possessed in Vienna the gateway to Southeast Europe. As the capital of the old Austro-Hungarian Empire, Vienna had long stood at the center of the communications and the trading systems of Central and Southeast Europe. Now that nerve center was in German hands. Perhaps most important to Hitler was the demonstration again that neither Britain nor France would lift a finger to stop him. On March 14th, Chamberlain had addressed the Commons on Hitler's fait accompli in Austria, and the German embassy in London had got off to Berlin a succession of urgent telegrams on the course of the debate. There was not much for Hitler to fear. "The hard fact is," Chamberlain declared, "that nothing could have arrested what actually has happened in Austria, unless this country and other countries had been prepared to use force." The British Prime Minister, it became clear to Hitler, was unwilling not only to employ force, but even to concert with the other big powers about halting Germany's future moves. On March 17th, the Soviet government had proposed a conference of powers, within or without the League of Nations, to consider means of seeing that there was no further German aggression. Chamberlain took a chilly view of any such meeting, and on March 24th in the House of Commons publicly rejected it. "The inevitable consequence of any such action," he said, "would be to aggravate the tendency towards the establishment of exclusive groups of nations which must be inimical to the prospects of European peace." Apparently he overlooked, or did not take seriously, the Rome-Berlin Axis or the tripartite anti-Comintern Pact of Germany, Italy, and Japan. In the same speech, Chamberlain announced a decision of his government which must have been even more pleasing to Hitler. He bluntly rejected the suggestion not only that Britain should give a guarantee to come to the aid of Czechoslovakia in case she were attacked, but also that Britain should support France if the French were called upon to implement their obligations under the Franco-Czech Pact. This forthright statement eased Hitler's problems considerably. He now knew that Britain would also stand by when he took on his next victim. If Britain held back, would not France also? As his secret papers of the next few months make clear, he was sure of it. And he knew that, by the terms of the Russian pacts with France and Czechoslovakia, the Soviet Union was not obliged to come to the aid of the Czechs until the French moved first. Such knowledge was all that he needed to enable him to go ahead at once with his plans. The reluctant German generals, Hitler could assume after the success of the Anschluss, would no longer stand in his way. If he had any doubts at all on this, they were removed by the denouement of the Fritsch affair. As we have seen, General von Fritsch's trial before a military court of honor on charges of homosexualism had been abruptly suspended on its opening day, March 10th, when Field Marshal Göring and the commanders of the Army and Navy were convoked by Hitler to handle more urgent affairs in connection with Austria. The trial resumed on March 17th, but in view of what had happened in the interval, it was bound to be anticlimactic. A few weeks before, the senior generals had been confident that when the military court exposed the unbelievable machinations of Himmler and Heydrich against Fritsch, not only would their fallen commander-in-chief be restored to his post in the army, but the SS, perhaps even the Third Reich, possibly even Adolf Hitler, would be shaken to a fall. Vain and empty hope. On February 4th, as has been recounted, Hitler had smashed the dreams of the old officer corps by taking over command of the armed forces himself and cashiering Fritsch and most of the high-ranking generals around him. Now he had conquered Austria without a shot. After this astounding triumph, nobody in Germany, not even the old generals, had much thought for General von Fritsch. True, he was quickly cleared. After some browbeating from Göring, who could now pose as the fairest of judges, the blackmailing ex-convict Schmidt broke down in court and confessed that the Gestapo had threatened his life unless he implicated General von Fritsch, a threat, incidentally, which was carried out anyway a few days later. and that the similarity of names between Fritsch and Rittmeister von Frisch, whom he had actually blackmailed for homosexualism, had led to the frame-up. No attempt was made by Fritsch or the army to expose the Gestapo's real role, nor the personal guilt of Himmler and Heydrich in cooking up the false charges. On the second day, March 18th, the trial was concluded with the inevitable verdict: proven not guilty as charged and acquitted. It was a personal exoneration for General von Fritsch, but it did not restore him to his command, nor the army to its former position of some independence in the Third Reich. Since the trial was held in camera, the public knew nothing of it or of the issues involved. On March 25th, Hitler sent a telegram to Fritsch congratulating him on his recovery of health. That was all. The deposed general, who had declined to point an accusing finger at Himmler in court, now made a final futile gesture. He challenged the Gestapo chief to a duel. The challenge, drawn up in strict accordance with the old military code of honor by General Beck himself, was given to General von Rundstedt, as the senior-ranking army officer, to deliver to the head of the SS. But Rundstedt got cold feet, carried it around in his pocket for weeks, and in the end forgot it. General von Fritsch and all he stood for soon faded out of German life. But what did he stand for in the end? In December, he was writing his friend Baroness Margot von Schutzbar a letter which indicated the pathetic confusion into which he, like so many of the other generals, had fallen. It is really strange that so many people should regard the future with increasing fears, in spite of the Führer's indisputable successes during the past years. Soon after the war, I came to the conclusion that we should have to be victorious in three battles if Germany were to become powerful again. 1. The battle against the working class. Hitler has won this. 2. Against the Catholic Church, perhaps better expressed against Ultramontanism. And 3. Against the Jews. We are in the midst of these battles, and the one against the Jews is the most difficult. I hope everyone realizes the intricacies of this campaign. On August 7, 1939, as the war clouds darkened, he wrote the Baroness, "For me there is, neither in peace nor in war, any part in Herr Hitler's Germany. I shall accompany my regiment only as a target, because I cannot stay at home." That is what he did. On August 11, 1938, he had been named Colonel-in-Chief of his old regiment, the 12th Artillery Regiment, a purely honorary title. On September 22, 1939, he was the target of a Polish machine gunner before beleaguered Warsaw, and 4 days later he was buried with full military honors in Berlin on a cold, rainy, dark morning, one of the dreariest days, according to my diary, I ever lived through in the capital. With Fritsch's discharge as commander-in-chief of the German army 20 months before, Hitler had won, as we have seen, a complete victory over the last citadel of possible opposition in Germany, the old traditional army officer caste. Now, in the spring of 1938, by his clever coup in Austria, he had further established his hold on the army, demonstrating his bold leadership and emphasizing that he alone would make the decisions in foreign policy, and that it was the army's role merely to supply the force, or the threat of force. Moreover, he had given the army, without the sacrifice of a man, a strategic position which rendered Czechoslovakia militarily indefensible. There was no time to lose in taking advantage of it. On April 21st, 11 days after the Nazi plebiscite in Austria, Hitler called in General Keitel, chief of the High Command of the Armed Forces, to discuss Case Green. Chapter 12. The Road to Munich. Case Green was the code name of the plan for a surprise attack on Czechoslovakia. It had first been drawn up, as we have seen, on June 24, 1937, by Field Marshal von Blomberg, and Hitler had elaborated on it in his lecture to the generals on November 5th, admonishing them that the descent upon the Czechs would have to be carried out with lightning speed, and that it might take place as early as 1938. Obviously, the easy conquest of Austria now made Case Green a matter of some urgency. The plan must be brought up to date, and preparations for carrying it out begun. It was for this purpose that Hitler summoned Keitel on April 21, 1938. On the following day, Major Rudolf Schmundt, The Führer's new military aide prepared a summary of the discussion, which was divided into three parts: political aspects, military conclusions, and propaganda. Hitler rejected the idea of strategic attack out of the blue without cause or possibility of justification because of hostile world opinion which might lead to a critical situation. He thought a second alternative, action after a period of diplomatic discussions which gradually lead to a crisis and to war, was undesirable because green security measures will have been taken. The Führer preferred, at the moment at least, a third alternative. Lightning action based on an incident, for example, the murder of the German minister in the course of an anti-German demonstration. Such an incident, it will be remembered, was at one time planned to justify a German invasion of Austria, when Papen was to have been the victim. In Hitler's gangster world, German envoys abroad were certainly expendable. The German warlord, as he now was, since he had taken over personal command of the armed forces, emphasized to General Keitel the necessity of speed in the operations. The first 4 days of military action are, politically speaking, decisive. In the absence of outstanding military successes, a European crisis is certain to rise. Fait accompli must convince foreign powers of the hopelessness of military intervention. As for the propaganda side of the war, it was not yet time to call in Dr. Goebbels. Hitler merely discussed leaflets for the conduct of the Germans in Czechoslovakia, and those which would contain threats to intimidate the Czechs. The Republic of Czechoslovakia, which Hitler was now determined to destroy, was the creation of the peace treaties, so hateful to the Germans, after the First World War. It was also the handiwork of two remarkable Czech intellectuals, Tomáš Garrigue Masaryk, a self-educated son of a coachman, who became a noted savant and the country's first president, and Eduard Beneš, son of a peasant, who worked his way through the University of Prague and three French institutions of higher learning, and who, after serving almost continually as foreign minister, became the second president on the retirement of Masaryk in 1935. Carved out of the Habsburg Empire, which in the 16th century had acquired the ancient kingdom of Bohemia, Czechoslovakia developed during the years that followed its founding in 1918 into the most democratic, progressive, enlightened, and prosperous state in Central Europe. But by its very makeup of several different nationalities, it was gripped from the beginning by a domestic problem which over 20 years it had not been able entirely to solve. This was the question of its minorities. Within the country lived 1 million Hungarians, 500,000 Ruthenians, and 3.25 million Sudeten Germans. These peoples looked longingly toward their mother countries, Hungary, Russia, and Germany, respectively, though the Sudeteners had never belonged to the German Reich, except as a part of the loosely formed Holy Roman Empire, but only to Austria. At the least, these minorities desired more autonomy than they had been given. Even the Slovaks, who formed a quarter of the 10 million Czechoslovaks, wanted some measure of autonomy. Although racially and linguistically closely related to the Czechs, the Slovaks had developed differently, historically, culturally, and economically, largely due to their centuries-old domination by Hungary. An agreement between Czech and Slovak emigres in America, signed in Pittsburgh on May 30, 1918, had provided for the Slovaks having their own government, parliament, and courts, but the government in Prague had not felt bound by this agreement and had not kept it. To be sure, compared to minorities in most other countries, even in the West, even in America, those in Czechoslovakia were not badly off. They enjoyed not only full democratic and civil rights, including the right to vote, but to a certain extent were given their own schools and allowed to maintain their own cultural institutions. Leaders of the minority political parties often served as ministers in the central government. Nevertheless, the Czechs, not fully recovered from the effects of centuries of oppression by the Austrians, left a great deal to be desired in solving the minorities' problem. They were often chauvinistic and frequently tactless. I recall from my own earlier visits to the country the deep resentment in Slovakia against the imprisonment of Dr. Wojciech Tuka, at that time a respected professor, who had been sentenced to 15 years' confinement for treason, though it was doubtful that he was guilty of more than working for Slovak autonomy. Above all, the minority groups felt that the Czechoslovak government had not honored the promises made by Masaryk and Beneš to the Paris Peace Conference in 1919 to establish a cantonal system similar to that of Switzerland. Ironically enough, in view of what is now to be set down here, the Sudeten Germans had fared tolerably well in the Czechoslovak state, certainly better than any other minority in the country, and better than the German minorities in Poland or in fascist Italy. They resented the petty tyrannies of local Czech officials and the discrimination against them that sometimes occurred in Prague. They found it difficult to adjust to the loss of their former dominance in Bohemia and Moravia under the Habsburgs. But lying in compact groups along the northwestern and southwestern parts of the new republic, where most of the industry of the country was concentrated, they prospered, and as the years went by, they gradually reached a state of relative harmony with the Czechs, continuing always to press for more autonomy and more respect for their linguistic and cultural rights. Until the rise of Hitler, there was no serious political movement which asked for more. The Social Democrats and other democratic parties received most of the Sudeten votes. Then in 1933, when Hitler became chancellor, the virus of National Socialism struck the Sudeten Germans. In that year was formed the Sudeten German Party, SDP, under the leadership of a mild-mannered gymnastics teacher by the name of Konrad Henlein. By 1935, the party was being secretly subsidized by the German Foreign Office to the amount of 15,000 marks a month. Within a couple of years, it had captured the majority of the Sudeten Germans, only the Social Democrats and the Communists remaining outside it. By the time of the Anschluss, Henlein's party, which for 3 years had been taking its orders from Berlin, was ready to do the bidding of Adolf Hitler. To receive this bidding, Henlein sped to Berlin a fortnight after the annexation of Austria, and on March 28th was closeted with Hitler for 3 hours, Ribbentrop and Hess also being present. Hitler's instructions, as revealed in a Foreign Office memorandum, were that demands should be made by the Sudeten German Party which are unacceptable to the Czech government. As Henlein himself summarized the Führer's views, "We must always demand so much that we can never be satisfied." Thus, the plight of the German minority in Czechoslovakia was for Hitler merely a pretext, as Danzig was to be a year later in regard to Poland, for cooking up a stew in a land he coveted, undermining it, confusing and misleading its friends, and concealing his real purpose. What that purpose was he had made clear in his November 5th harangue to the military leaders and in the initial directives of Case Green: to destroy the Czechoslovak state and to grab its territories and inhabitants for the Third Reich. Despite what had happened in Austria, the leaders of France and Great Britain did not grasp this. All through the spring and summer, indeed almost to the end, Prime Minister Chamberlain and Premier Daladier apparently sincerely believed, along with most of the rest of the world, that all Hitler wanted was justice for his kinsfolk in Czechoslovakia. In fact, as the spring days grew warmer, the British and French governments went out of their way to pressure the Czech government to grant far-reaching concessions to the Sudeten Germans. On May 3rd, the new German ambassador in London, Herbert von Dirksen, was reporting to Berlin that Lord Halifax had informed him of a démarche the British government would shortly make in Prague, which would aim at inducing Beneš to show the utmost measure of accommodation to the Sudeten Germans. 4 days later, on May 7th, the British and French ministers in Prague made their démarche, urging the Czech government to go to the utmost limit, as the German minister reported to Berlin, to meet the Sudeten demands. Hitler and Ribbentrop seemed quite pleased to find that the British and French governments were so concerned with aiding them. Concealment of German aims, however, was more than ever necessary at this stage. On May 12th, Henlein paid a secret visit to the Wilhelmstrasse in Berlin, and received instructions from Ribbentrop on how to bamboozle the British when he arrived in London that evening to see Sir Robert Van Sittart, chief diplomatic adviser to the Foreign Secretary, and other British officials. A memorandum by Weizsäcker laid down the line to be taken. Henlein will deny in London that he is acting on instructions from Berlin. Finally, Henlein will speak of the progressive disintegration of the Czech political structure, in order to discourage those circles which consider that their intervention on behalf of this structure may still be of use. On the same day, the German minister in Prague was wiring Ribbentrop about the need of precaution to cover his legation in its work of handing over money and instructions to the Sudeten German Party. Hugh R. Wilson, the American ambassador in Berlin, called on Weizsäcker on May 14th to discuss the Sudeten crisis, and was told of German fears that Czech authorities were deliberately provoking a European crisis in order to try to prevent the disintegration of Czechoslovakia. 2 days later, on May 16th, Major Schmundt got off an urgent and most secret telegram to OKW headquarters on behalf of Hitler, who was resting at Obersalzberg, asking how many divisions on the Czech frontier were ready to march within 12 hours in the case of mobilization. Lieutenant Colonel Zeitzler of the OKW staff replied immediately, 12. This did not satisfy Hitler. "Please send the numbers of the divisions," he asked, and the answer came back, listing 10 infantry divisions by their numbers and adding one armored and one mountain division. Hitler was getting restless for action. The next day, the 17th, he was inquiring of OKW for precise information on the fortifications which the Czechs had constructed in the Sudeten Mountains on their borders. These were known as the Czech Maginot Line. Zeitzler replied from Berlin on the same day with a long and most secret telegram, informing the Führer in considerable detail of the Czech defense works. He made it clear that they were fairly formidable. The First Crisis, May 1938. The weekend which began on Friday, May 20th, developed into a critical one and would later be remembered as the May Crisis. During the ensuing 48 hours, the governments in London, Paris, Prague, and Moscow were panicked into the belief that Europe stood nearer to war than it had at any time since the summer of 1914. This may have been largely due to the possibility that new plans for a German attack on Czechoslovakia, which were drawn up for Hitler by OKW and presented to him on that Friday, leaked out. At any rate, it was believed, at least in Prague and London, that Hitler was about to launch aggression against Czechoslovakia. In this belief, the Czechs began to mobilize, and Britain, France, and Russia displayed a firmness and a unity in the face of what their governments feared to be an imminent German threat, which they were not to show again until a new world war had almost destroyed them. On Friday, May 20th, General Keitel dispatched to Hitler at the Obersalzberg a new draft of Case Green, which he and his staff had been working on since the Führer had laid down the general lines for it in their meeting on April 21st. In an obsequious letter to the leader attached to the new plan, Keitel explained that it took into account the situation created by the incorporation of Austria into the German Reich, and that it would not be discussed with the commanders-in-chief of the three armed services until you, my Führer, approved it and signed it. The new directive for Green, dated Berlin, May 20, 1938, is an interesting and significant document. It is a model of the kind of Nazi planning for aggression with which the world later became acquainted. "It is not my intention," it began, "to smash Czechoslovakia by military action in the immediate future without provocation, unless an unavoidable development within Czechoslovakia forces the issue, or political events in Europe create a particularly favorable opportunity which may perhaps never recur." Three political possibilities for commencing the operation are considered. The first, a sudden attack without convenient outward excuse, is rejected. Operations preferably will be launched either A, after a period of increasing diplomatic controversies and tension linked with military preparations, which will be exploited so as to shift the war guilt on the enemy, B, by lightning action as the result of a serious incident which will subject Germany to unbearable provocation, and which, in the eyes of at least a part of world opinion, affords the moral justification for military measures. Case B is more favorable, both from a military and a political point of view. As for the military operation itself, it was to attain such a success within 4 days that it would demonstrate to enemy states which may wish to intervene the hopelessness of the Czech military position, and also provide an incentive to those states which have territorial claims upon Czechoslovakia to join in immediately against her. Those states were Hungary and Poland, and the plan counted on their intervention. Whether France would honor its obligations to the Czechs was considered doubtful, but attempts by Russia to give Czechoslovakia military support are to be expected. The German high command, or at least Keitel and Hitler, were so confident that the French would not fight that only a minimum strength is to be provided as a rear cover in the west. And it was emphasized that the whole weight of all forces must be employed in the invasion of Czechoslovakia. The task of the bulk of the army, aided by the Luftwaffe, was to smash the Czechoslovak army and to occupy Bohemia and Moravia as quickly as possible. It was to be total war, and for the first time in the planning of German soldiers, the value of what the directive calls propaganda warfare and economic warfare is emphasized, and their employment woven into the overall military plan of attack. Propaganda warfare must, on the one hand, intimidate the Czechs by means of threats and wear down their power of resistance. On the other hand, it must give the national minorities indications as to how to support our military operations and influence the neutrals in our favor. Economic warfare has the task of employing all available economic resources to hasten the final collapse of the Czechs. In the course of military operations, it is important to help to increase the total economic war effort by rapidly collecting information about important factories and setting them going again as soon as possible. For this reason, the sparing, as far as military operations permit, of Czech industrial and engineering establishments may be of decisive importance to us. This model for Nazi aggression was to remain essentially unchanged and to be used with staggering success until an aroused world much later woke up to it. Shortly after noon on May 20th, the German minister in Prague sent an urgent and most secret wire to Berlin, reporting that the Czech foreign minister had just informed him by telephone that his government was perturbed by reports of concentration of German troops in Saxony. He had replied, he said, that there were absolutely no grounds for anxiety, but he requested Berlin to inform him immediately what, if anything, was up. This was the first of a series of feverish diplomatic exchanges that weekend, which shook Europe with the fear that Hitler was about to move again, and that this time a general war would follow. The basis for the information received by British and Czech intelligence, that German troops were concentrating on the Czech border, has never, so far as I know, come to light. To a Europe still under the shock of the German military occupation of Austria, there were several straws in the wind. On May 19th, a newspaper in Leipzig had published a report of German troop movements. Henlein, the Sudetenführer, had announced the breaking off of his party's negotiations with the Czech government on May 9th, and it was known that on his return from London on the 14th he had stopped off at Berchtesgaden to see Hitler and that he was still there. There were shooting affrays in the Sudetenland. And all through May, Dr. Goebbels's propaganda war, featuring wild stories of Czech terror against the Sudeten Germans, had been stepped up. The tension seemed to be reaching a climax. Though there was some movement of German troops in connection with spring maneuvers, particularly in the eastern regions, no evidence was ever found from the captured German documents indicating any sudden new concentration of armed forces on the Czech border at this moment. On the contrary, two German Foreign Office papers dated May 21st contained confidential assurances to the Wilhelmstrasse from Colonel Jodl of the OKW that there had been no such concentrations either in Silesia or in Lower Austria. There had been nothing, Jodl asserted in messages not intended for foreign perusal, apart from peacetime maneuvers. It was not that the Czech border was denuded of German troops. As we have seen, on May 16th, Hitler had been informed by OKW, in answer to his urgent request for information, that there were 12 German divisions on the Czech frontier, ready to march within 12 hours. Could it have been that Czech or British intelligence got wind of the telegrams which exchanged this information, and that they learned of the new directive for Green which Keitel dispatched for Hitler's approval on May 20th? For on the next day, the Czech Chief of Staff, General Krejci, told the German military attaché in Prague, Colonel Toussaint, that he had irrefutable proof that in Saxony a concentration of from 8 to 10 German divisions had taken place. The figures on the number of divisions were not far from correct, even if the information on the manner of their deployment was somewhat inaccurate. At any rate, on the afternoon of May 20th, following an emergency cabinet session at Hradčin Palace in Prague, presided over by President Beneš, the Czechs decided on an immediate partial mobilization. One class was called to the colors, and certain technical reservists were mobilized. The Czech government, in contrast to the Austrian 2 months before, did not intend to give up without a fight. The Czech mobilization, partial though it was, sent Adolf Hitler into a fit of fury, and his feelings were not assuaged by the dispatches that arrived for him at Obersalzberg from the German Foreign Office in Berlin, telling of continual calls by the British and French ambassadors, warning Germany that aggression against Czechoslovakia meant a European war. The Germans had never been subjected to such strenuous and persistent diplomatic pressure as the British employed on this weekend. Sir Neville Henderson, the British ambassador, who had been sent to Berlin by Prime Minister Chamberlain to apply his skills as a professional diplomat to the appeasement of Hitler, and who applied them to the utmost, called repeatedly at the German Foreign Office to inquire about German troop movements and to advise caution. There is no doubt that he was egged on by Lord Halifax and the British Foreign Office, for Henderson, a suave, debonair diplomat, had little sympathy with the Czechs, as all who knew him in Berlin were aware. He saw Ribbentrop twice on May 21st, and on the next day, though it was a Sunday, called on State Secretary von Weizsäcker, Ribbentrop having been hastily convoked to Hitler's presence at Obersalzberg, to deliver a personal message from Halifax stressing the gravity of the situation. In London, the British Foreign Secretary also called in the German ambassador on the Sabbath and emphasized how grave the moment was. In all these British communications, the Germans did not fail to note, as Ambassador von Dirksen pointed out in a dispatch after seeing Halifax, that the British government, while certain that France would go to the aid of Czechoslovakia, did not affirm that Britain would too. The furthest the British would go was to warn, as Dirksen says Halifax did, that in the event of a European conflict it was impossible to foresee whether Britain would not be drawn into it. As a matter of fact, this was as far as Chamberlain's government would ever go, until it was too late to stop Hitler. It was this writer's impression in Berlin from that moment until the end, that had Chamberlain frankly told Hitler that Britain would do what it ultimately did in the face of Nazi aggression, the Führer would never have embarked on the adventures which brought on the Second World War, an impression which has been immensely strengthened by the study of the secret German documents. This was the well-meaning Prime Minister's fatal mistake. Adolf Hitler, brooding fitfully in his mountain retreat above Berchtesgaden, felt deeply humiliated by the Czechs and by the support given them in London, Paris, and even Moscow. And nothing could have put the German dictator in a blacker, uglier mood. His fury was all the more intense because he was accused prematurely of being on the point of committing an aggression which he indeed intended to commit. That very weekend he had gone over the new plan for Green submitted by Keitel. But it could not be carried out at once. Swallowing his pride, he ordered the Foreign Office in Berlin to inform the Czech envoy on Monday, May 23rd, that Germany had no aggressive intentions toward Czechoslovakia, and that the reports of German troop concentrations on her borders were without foundation. In Prague, London, Paris, and Moscow, the government leaders breathed a sigh of relief. The crisis had been mastered. Hitler had been given a lesson. He must now know he could not get away with aggression as easily as he had done in Austria. Little did these statesmen know the Nazi dictator. After sulking at Obersalzberg a few more days, during which there grew within him a burning rage to get even with Czechoslovakia, and particularly with President Beneš, who he believed had deliberately humiliated him, he suddenly appeared in Berlin on May 28th and convoked the ranking officers of the Wehrmacht to the Chancellery to hear a momentous decision. He himself told of it in a speech to the Reichstag 8 months later. "I resolved to solve once and for all, and this radically, the Sudeten question. On May 28th I ordered, 1. That preparations should be made for military action against this state by October 2nd, 2. That the construction of our western defenses should be greatly extended and speeded up. The immediate mobilization of 96 divisions was planned to begin with." To his assembled Confederates, Göring, Keitel, Brauchitsch, Beck, Admiral Raeder, Ribbentrop, and Neurath, he thundered, It is my unshakable will that Czechoslovakia shall be wiped off the map. Case Green was again brought out and again revised. Jodl's diary traces what had been going on in Hitler's feverish, vindictive mind. The intention of the Führer not to activate the Czech problem as yet is changed because of the Czech strategic troop concentration of May 21st, which occurs without any German threat and without the slightest cause for it. Because of Germany's self-restraint, its consequences lead to a loss of prestige of the Führer, which he is not willing to take again. Therefore, the new directive for Green is issued on May 30th. The details of the new directive on Case Green, which Hitler signed on May 30th, do not differ essentially from those of the version submitted to Hitler 9 days before. But there are two significant changes. Instead of the opening sentence of May 21st, which read, "It is not my intention to smash Czechoslovakia in the near future," the new directive began, "It is my unalterable decision to smash Czechoslovakia by military action in the near future." What the near future meant was explained by Keitel in a covering letter. "Green's execution," he ordered, "must be assured by October 1, 1938 at the latest." It was a date which Hitler would adhere to through thick and thin, through crisis after crisis, and at the brink of war, without flinching. Wavering of the Generals. After noting in his diary on May 30th that Hitler had signed the new directive for Green and that because of its demand for an immediate breakthrough into Czechoslovakia right on X day, the previous intentions of the army must be changed considerably, Jodl added the following sentence. The whole contrast becomes acute once more between the Führer's intuition that we must do it this year and the opinion of the army that we cannot do it as yet because most certainly the Western powers will interfere and we are not as yet equal to them. The perceptive Wehrmacht staff officer had put his finger on a new rift between Hitler and some of the highest-ranking generals of the army. The opposition to the Führer's grandiose plans for aggression was led by General Ludwig Beck, chief of the Army General Staff, who henceforth would assume the leadership of such resistance as there was to Hitler in the Third Reich. Later, this sensitive, intelligent, decent, but indecisive general would base his struggle against the Nazi dictator on broad grounds. As late as the spring of 1938, however, after more than 4 years of National Socialism, Beck opposed the Führer only on the narrower professional grounds that Germany was not yet strong enough to take on the Western powers, and perhaps Russia as well. Beck, as we have seen, had welcomed Hitler's coming to power and had publicly acclaimed the Führer for re-establishing the conscript German army in defiance of Versailles. As far back as 1930, it will be remembered from earlier pages, Beck, then an obscure regimental commander, had gone out of his way to defend three of his subalterns on a treason charge that they were fomenting Nazism in the armed forces, and, in fact, had testified in their favor before the Supreme Court after Hitler had appeared on the stand and warned that when he came to power, heads would roll. It was not the Führer's aggression against Austria, which Beck had supported, but the rolling of General von Fritsch's head after the Gestapo frame-up, which seems to have cleared his mind. Swept of its cobwebs, it began to perceive that Hitler's policy of deliberately risking war with Britain, France, and Russia, against the advice of the top generals, would, if carried out, be the ruin of Germany. Beck had got wind of Hitler's meeting with Keitel on April 21st, in which the Wehrmacht was instructed to hasten plans for attacking Czechoslovakia. And on May 5th, he wrote out the first of a series of memoranda for General von Brauchitsch, the new commander-in-chief of the army, strenuously opposing any such action. They are brilliant papers, blunt as to unpleasant facts and full of solid reasoning and logic. Although Beck overestimated the strength of will of Britain and France, the political shrewdness of their leaders and the power of the French army, and in the end proved wrong on the outcome of the Czech problem, his long-range predictions turned out, so far as Germany was concerned, to be deadly accurate. Beck was convinced, he wrote in his May 5th memorandum, that a German attack on Czechoslovakia would provoke a European war in which Britain, France, and Russia would oppose Germany, and in which the United States would be the arsenal of the Western democracies. Germany simply could not win such a war. Its lack of raw materials alone made victory impossible. In fact, he contended, Germany's military-economic situation is worse than it was in 1917-18, when the collapse of the Kaiser's armies began. On May 28th, Beck was among the generals convoked to the Reich Chancellery after the May crisis to hear Hitler storm that he intended to wipe Czechoslovakia off the map the coming autumn. He took